Sébastien Lévesque, comment vas-tu?
Ça va très bien et toi, Émile Gauthier?
Ça va très bien et j'en profite pour vous annoncer que notre très attendue saison 8, ayant pour thème les Rabbit Holes, débutera le 4 octobre prochain sur toutes les plateformes.
Mais si vous êtes un membre Patreon, où que vous soyez dans le monde, elle débutera en avance, soit le 27 septembre. Patreon, c'est une plateforme de sociofinancement à abonnement mensuel qui vous donne accès à du contenu exclusif de Distorsion et à tous nos épisodes en avance, le tout sans publicité. On vous offre deux forfaits exclusifs pour nous supporter.
À 3 $ canadiens par mois, vous avez accès au forfait Distordu, qui vous offre un shout-out dans un épisode, l'accès au serveur Discord VIP, accès aux épisodes réguliers en avance, accès aux épisodes bonus en avance, 10 % de rabais sur la boutique, et ce, à chaque mois.
On a aussi le forfait Oui, monsieur! À 8 $ canadiens par mois, vous obtenez tout ce qui est inclus dans le forfait Distordu. Vous avez en plus accès à du contenu exclusif qui est dédié à ce forfait, comme un after-show après chaque épisode, des interviews, des discussions off the record, etc. Vous avez aussi également accès à un épisode secret par saison, sans parler que vous avez accès aux épisodes secrets des saisons précédentes. Également, vous avez 20 % de rabais sur la boutique à chaque mois.
Rendez-vous au patreon.com/distorsion pour vous abonner et devenir des commanditaires officiels de Distorsion.
On vous remercie énormément de votre soutien et bonne écoute.
You are about to listen to Distortion, a podcast about
mysteries, crime, the paranormal, and the weird.
Strange stories from the internet.
Bonjour chers enfants de l'internet, ici Émile et c'est Distorsion pour un épisode bonus. Sébastien ne pouvait pas se joindre à nous ce soir, donc ce sera moi en solo. On a eu la chance de parler du cas de Emma Filipov plus tôt lors de notre saison 2. Je vous conseille d'aller écouter l'épisode si vous ne l'avez pas fait déjà, parce que aujourd'hui je reçois en entrevue Jordan Bonaparte du Nighttime Podcast. Si vous n'avez jamais eu la chance d'écouter le Nighttime Podcast, je vous suggère fortement de le faire. C'est un des meilleurs podcasts canadiens et Jordan, à partir d'Halifax, va analyser des cas mystérieux d'histoires canadiennes. Ça peut aller autant des ovnis jusque, par exemple, le trésor de l'île de Oak Island, que moi, est un sujet qui me passionne beaucoup. Jordan a eu la chance de couvrir le cas d'Emma Filipov. Il en a fait plusieurs épisodes. Il a aussi fait plusieurs interviews avec des gens de l'entourage de Emma et il vient tout juste de lancer un nouveau podcast qui s'intitule Emma Filipov is missing et ce soir on va avoir la chance de discuter un peu de nos points de vue sur le cas mais aussi bien au-delà de ça on va discuter de podcasts en général et de ce qui nous passionne dans chacun des sujets de nos émissions respectives. Mais ce soir on a une bière de la semaine qui nous est offerte cette fois-ci par Martin Saint-André via la tournée de bière sur notre site web donc au distorsionpodcast.com. Vous pouvez aller dans l'onglet tournée de bière et encourager le show et nous suggérer des bonnes bières. Cette semaine, on boit la Coastal Lager de la brasserie Spindrift. C'est une brasserie qui vient de Dartmouth en Nouvelle-Écosse. Donc, shout-out à nos auditeurs de cette région-là, de l'Est du Canada. C'est une magnifique lager, je dirais de couleur ambrée, à 5 % d'alcool, vraiment délicieuse. On veut aussi donner un shout-out à Misty Gris qui nous a donné une review 5 étoiles sur Apple Podcast. Misty Gris nous dit « Un très bon podcast que j'ai découvert cet été et consommé à une vitesse folle. Donc, merci à toi, Misty Gris. C'est pour des gens comme toi qu'on fait le show. Aussi, si vous voulez nous rejoindre, c'est simple, distorsion.com distorsionpodcast.com. Vous pouvez le faire aussi sur Facebook, /distorsionpodcast, sur Instagram avec le même nom et sur Twitter à distorsionpod. Et n'hésitez pas à rejoindre notre groupe de discussion sur Facebook parce qu'il y a plein de conversations qui sont en cours. On discute des sujets, on mène l'enquête et vous pouvez nous suggérer des idées d'épisodes aussi. Donc, sans plus tarder, on se retrouve sur Skype avec Jordan du Nighttime Podcast. Hey Jordan, it's a pleasure to have you on Distortion and having you on the phone. It's been a while since we talked about doing some sort of collaboration between our two shows.
Yeah, there's not a lot of Canadian podcasters, and there's certainly not a lot of French Canadian podcasters. So I'm glad to meet you in person, and well, I should say not so much in person, but in voice through the internet. But I'm really glad you guys are doing what you're doing. I hear from a lot of French Canadians who ask me about to cover certain cases from Montreal and whatnot. And when I go to search through the articles, most of them are written in French. So from now on, rather than using Google Translator, I'm just going to refer them to you and send you those articles.
Oh, that's so kind. We do the same. And especially what I like with especially the Nighttime Podcast, and we'll talk about your new spin-off series as well. But what I like is that you cover cases that are, you know, specifically Canadian, and, you know, most specifically from the eastern part of Canada, which is not an area that we hear a lot from.
The idea of covering something local and, you know, to my geographical region of Canada, that was my plan from the very beginning. There's so many podcasts that I listen to that all kind of share the same major stories that most people have heard, and you know, they try to put their own spin on it, but often I'm listening to them and hearing them describe a story I already know. A lot of the stories that I've always been passionate about and, you know, researched and been into were the ones that occur in my part of Canada, you know, the eastern part of Canada. So when, and that's something where I've often, like, I'm the type where I'm on Twitter and Facebook writing to the different shows I listen to, and I'll recommend they cover these cases close to me, and it just kind of never happened. So I just figured, why not just cover them myself? An example would be the story of Alan Legere. He was one of Canada's worst serial killers. He did his crimes in New Brunswick. In my mind, this is a case that has terrified me since I was a little kid, and I just have never heard anyone else cover it. So when I launched my podcast, that was, you know, one of the first that I did. It also helped with gaining an audience by covering local cases. It kind of I already had an audience of people who lived kind of around me to kind of start with.
Yeah, that's amazing, and especially since Nova Scotia has a great history of mysterious cases, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, we're famous for the Oak Island mystery, of course, which, you know, the TV show Curse of Oak Island. And that's, you know, basically at my doorstep. We also have the Shag Harbor UFO sighting, which is referred to as Canada's Roswell. And also very close. I've been in Shag Harbor multiple times. But Nova Scotia just has a long history of, you know, folklore and haunted ships and ghost stories. So it's just, you know, I've been raised surrounded by these little mysteries.
Yeah. And when did you get hooked by the Emma Filipov case? Because you covered a lot of this case.
Yeah, it's my introduction to Emma's story is a lot like many other Canadians, where I watched the CBC Fifth Estate documentary, Finding Emma. And when I first watched that documentary, it was shortly after my son was born. So I have a young son. At the time, maybe a two-year-old son, I had a bit of a vulnerability with the idea of like something bad happening to someone's child. So when I went into the documentary, you know, maybe 5 minutes into it, I was just watching Shelley, Emma's mother, talk and thinking, like, how is this lady able to even, you know, lift her head up, not knowing what, you know, what's become of her daughter. So that's kind of like 5 minutes into that documentary, I really felt a connection with what Shelley was going through. But then as I watched the rest of the documentary and my research that I did after watching it, I realized that Emma's a lot like me and a lot like a lot of my friends, where she's just a
Like, I've always kind of been around the artsy type of people. I was a musician back in the day. So it's like I have a lot of friends who are kind of dreamy and whimsical, like Emma. So Shelley reminded me a lot of people I know, and Emma certainly reminded me a lot of the people I've known. And I guess just that was enough to really like sink my teeth into it and just put the story in my brain. What about you? I'm curious how, like, a French Canadian, I guess you may have been able to watch the documentary. How did you first find out about Emma's story?
Just like you, Jordan, I think it was while watching The Fifth Estate, finding Emma. I think it was in 2014, if I remember well. I don't know why, because, you know, there's dozens of thousands of missing people every year in Canada. And I think the reason why I got hooked by the Emma case is probably because, like you said, we kind of identify to Emma. Like she was a young girl with a bright future in front of her. She had projects. She liked to travel and all that. But it seems like something happened. There was like a tipping point at some moment where everything switched, 180 degree. That's the missing link. What happened during those few days or those few hours on that cold night of November? And I think that trying to find this moment that happened in a very, very short time, that's what got me hooked at the very first place.
Yeah, another thing too that I can relate to, or maybe not so much relate to, but that makes me invested in the case, is Emma didn't have any kind of negative stuff going on in her life. She wasn't, hooked on drugs or doing anything extremely risky. It seemed like she was just kind of a slave to a slowly evolving mental health problem. And just, whatever happened at the end of November, in the days, weeks leading to her disappearance, it just seemed like she lost control of something that she was, barely in control of maybe for the last year or two. But it's just, if you look at the timeline of that day, it's such a mystery and you have so many questions. You have Emma in the middle of it, who is just, seems like an amazing person. And then Shelley, is such a great spokesperson for the whole case and does such a great job, speaking. It's just hard not to, get into it and want to get involved. Do you know of any other French coverage of Emma's story? Like, I think your episode that you did on Distortion is the first French coverage of Emma's case, as far as I know.
I haven't heard anything else, to be honest. I'm not even sure that we had newspapers covering it in French Canada, because, we usually, when the Fifth Estate does like a big investigation or a big cover story, there's the French version of it on, Radio-Canada, which is the French side of the CBC. We have a show called Enquête, which is some sort of a French version of the Fifth Estate, but they didn't cover Emma's case. And I was surprised because, there were sightings of Emma in Quebec. So I was surprised that there was no coverage. And I had the same reaction when I started talking with people from the Help Find Emma Philippoff Facebook page. It seems like we were among the first, French Canadian to cover it. So it's kind of sad. It looks like this story got a lot of exposure in the United States, and in, English Canada, but not a lot on the French side, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it has some French connections, because it has Shelley, Emma's mother, was a French teacher. Erica Schmidt, who wrote, I don't know if you read this, she wrote the Where is Emma Philippoff series blog posts. She is a French translator, I believe. And then with Julian's French to English translation, it is a lot of what led to him being considered a suspect. He used the word stalker in such a way that people began to, really look at him. Mm-hmm. Or not stalker, but stalk. He said something like, "I'm sorry for stalking Emma," to Emma's dad. When people started to question him about it, he explained that he chose too strong of an English word by saying stalk. And he meant to say something to the effect of, like, I've been pursuing her romantically, not stalking her like a creep. What do you think of that explanation as a French-speaking guy?
I would say that that's the type of word that we could use, you know, mistakenly. But yeah, because there's not a lot of different alternative to this word, you know what I'm saying. So, but I think it had a very very bad context, you know, when saying that at that time. It was a very very bad choice of word, of course.
Yeah, because I had spoke to him about it, and what he told us, he wanted to say something like, "I'm sorry for pursuing your daughter and trying to, you know, get in a relationship with her." Like something like that. And he just chose the word stalk, which, you know, in English has a way different context. Stalk is a lot different than you know, try to, I can't think of another word for it, but I think you know what I mean. Like, it's hard to, you know, it's just words can be powerful. And if, you know, if you're speaking in a language that's not your first language, it's probably easy to offend somebody. I work with a lot of, in my job, I work with a lot of French-speaking people, and just little things like, I find if I'm sarcastic or if I just, you know, crack a joke with them, sometimes they look at me like, this guy is crazy. But I'm realizing they're just not getting, you know, the context that the joke is in or whatnot. So you kind of, I find when I'm speaking to someone whose French is their first language, I really think about what I'm saying, and I feel like maybe Julian just didn't think about it and, you know, chose the wrong word.
Yeah, it was kind of strange to use such a strong word with someone that you're not very familiar with.
Yeah, it's Julian is an interesting character in all this, but having spoke with him as much as I did, I don't feel like he could be involved in anything. That's just my gut. But I also think I just can't picture how he would have been able to, if he runs it, let's just say he was this lunatic murderer. If he runs into Emma in downtown Victoria, I just don't see how, without a car or a vehicle or, you know, a house or something, I don't see how he could even, you know, do anything. But that's at least my gut about the whole thing.
It's not an easy situation with Julian because, you know, at the same time, he got ruled out by police officers. You know, I get his version of the story. But I just think that there's so many coincidences, you know, that happened during this trip to BC. He has seen Emma so many times, and I don't know why he didn't make a move or something, or maybe that there's something that he didn't tell you or even the investigators. But yeah, it was kind of the perfect suspect for the investigators.
Absolutely, and I think that's why the Fifth Estate, when they did their documentary, he was a very easy villain to portray.
Yes.
And they really set him up that way. Like, if, you know, if you don't look into it and you just watch that documentary, you would leave that thinking, you know, that guy likely had something to do with it. But it's, yeah, the coincidences are crazy and extreme. It's hard for me to believe that it's all just a coincidence, but even if he was, you know, quote unquote stalking her, to me, that still doesn't mean he had any involvement in it.
Yeah, me too. I think the same. I think that, you know, I'm pretty sure that, you know, when we talked about that on Distortion with my partner, Seb, I think it was pretty clear that Julian had some sort of he had some sort of romantic intentions towards Emma. I think he was maybe a little bit obsessed with her, but yeah, I don't think at all he was involved in her disappearance.
Mm-hmm. Now, with your show, I understand that you guys on Distortion focus a lot on the, you know, the technological stuff and, you know, the online communities. In what you did on your episode, did you get deep into, you know, the online community talking about Emma's case and examining the evidence?
Yeah, exactly. One of the topics that we really like, and that's very something that is linked to what you do and what the Generation Y do on their side as well, is, you know, I feel there's some sort of crowdsourcing of investigation now. We've seen it on many cases. I would say especially the Maura Murray case that was, you know, followed by the internet communities from all around the world. And And that's something that is really interesting for us, because we covered case, about the dark web. We covered the John McAfee case, some sort of topics that are more linked to the digital age or the way we interact with technology or the internet. But in Emma's case, it was mostly the online communities gathering together on Facebook groups, trying to analyze the different evidences and work that you do, Jordan, on the side. I think it really helped gathering the communities together and talking about the different evidences and the different theories. We've seen a lot of people were witnesses. Apparently, there was a lot of Emma sightings throughout the years. There were a few of them in the Quebec area, and we would have never known all of these sightings and all of these information without the internet communities. So for us, that was an interesting choice, and it's also an ongoing story. Every season we do 12 episodes, so we try to do a few disappearances. And when we were doing our programming for this season, I think Emma's case was a good one, still ongoing, still very active on the internet. Her mother is very involved with the search. There's a lot of volunteers online that help. So we wanted to try to bring something new to the conversation and try to get some of our audience aware of this case. So I don't know, maybe we'll get new evidences.
Yeah, well, it's there's so many cases, like you mentioned, Maura Murray's. There's a lot of cases that have an online community kind of actively debating and theorizing and whatnot. But I find so many of the cases have negative undertones to the online communities, where it's mostly like trolling and fighting it out. Emma's case, I find, is like a shining example of an online community that's actually effective. Like the Help Find Emma team, which is the group of volunteers that are supporting Shelley, they run such a tight ship. They're very professional and organized, and they're not publicly pointing fingers and battling it out. For the most part, they remain anonymous, which just speaks to their integrity. With Emma's case, comparing it to Maura Murray's case, because I'm friends with Tim and Lance from Missing Maura Murray. What I see happening in their case, the Maura Murray case, is completely different in Emma's. I find the online community surrounding Emma Filipov's case, maybe it's just because they're mostly Canadian, but I find it's really polite and helpful, welcoming and friendly, and it's actually getting things done. Like, if there's ever any sightings or tips or leads, it's very organized the way it makes it kind of up the levels to get to Shelley and to the investigators and whatnot. So I think this is a case where the online community certainly could make a difference and may likely break the case one day.
And speaking of online communities, one of the topics regarding Emma's case that was a lot discussed is the green t-shirt guy, And I'm still surprised that we haven't found this guy, because it's kind of crazy. Now you can get filmed on the internet, and sometimes people will spot you real quick. You can even go and rob a corner store, or you cannot do like a gas station robbery anymore, because if you get filmed and it got posted on Facebook, they will find you real quick. So what is your thinking about this green t-shirt guy?
I'm shocked that he hasn't turned up. The video of him, although it's not perfectly clear, it's not awful video. You can see him, you can see his face, his tattoos. For the most part, at least you can figure out the negative space kind of surrounding his tattoo. It's such a mystery that it drives me crazy. Like I try to think if he did have something to do with it, and let's say Emma was back at his apartment and he didn't want her to be found, then it makes me wonder, like, then why would he go in that store and make a big scene out of it? So like the way he acted to me seems more like just some lunatic who's high on drugs, who just walks in the store and says the wrong thing, and it makes its way to investigators and becomes kind of a red herring in the investigation. That's one side of it. But at the other hand, you know, this could be a big lead and people need to find this guy. And, you know, with podcasts like Distortion or my show or Generation Y covering Emma's story, that just gets Green Shirt Guy's photo spread further. Mm-hmm. And eventually it's going to get to someone where they're like, whoa, I know that guy. I used to work with him at, you know, the call center. You know, something like that is eventually going to happen and they're going to find this guy. I think it's just a matter of time, but I'm shocked it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, because for me, it's one of the biggest, you know, missing links in Emma's case because, you know, let's say he's right. Let's say that Emma is his girlfriend and he's coming to this store with this piece of paper, this, you know, missing poster. And let's say he's right. How would you do that? Because if you're right, you're getting filmed. I mean, you are in a store, you know, in 2015 or something, you're most likely getting filmed. So why are you doing it? And if he's wrong, I mean, what's the idea behind it? Because I mean, if you're wrong, you will most likely get in trouble because you lied to this guy and you got filmed, and probably, you know, the police or the investigators will come to your place really, really quick. So for me, I really don't get what happened on that day. I think like you said, someone getting really high or totally out of his mind is probably the theory that works
the only
best.
Thing that really, yeah, it's the only thing that fits, because whether Emma's his girlfriend or he doesn't know Emma at all, it neither makes sense, his behavior. So like, I just want them to find him just so they can kind of scratch that, you know, put an X over his face and move on. But until he turns up, like just think about, you know, this is me and you talking about it. Imagine how Shelley, Emma's mother, must feel mm-hmm. when, you know, to have a lead that's that huge and she knows he's out there somewhere. And maybe if it's only a 1% chance that this guy knows where Emma is, that would be enough for, you know, to keep Shelley up for, you know, probably 5 years now. She probably hasn't slept through the night. And I'm thinking it's pretty safe to say she has nightmares with Green Shirt Guy in them, you know, a couple nights a week.
Mm-hmm. On your nighttime podcast, Jordan, you got really, really close to Emma's family and friends. And how was it to collaborate with these people? How was it to get so close to your subject?
Well, it's getting close, especially with Shelley, getting to know her and becoming like close friends with Shelley is a big part of the motivation for me to continue to cover the case and try to make a difference. Like when I'm working on my podcast, if I'm covering, let's say, a UFO sighting from, you know, New Brunswick or something, it's interesting and it's fun and I want to do a good job so people are entertained when they listen to it. But when I settle to do an episode about Emma, it's a completely different feeling where I feel like I have a chance to help someone that I care about in a creative way. The end result of having a connection with Emma's friends and family, specifically her mother, Shelley, is just a huge motivator to do a good job and get the word out there and, you know, and promote awareness to this case. But there's also the darker side, which is covering Emma's story and researching and editing it. I have people that I'm close with, I feel their pain and it can just be like, it just feels a little darker. And that's often why I take breaks or I'll do a couple other stories between each Emma episode. Cause I do find it, it's dark and not that it's depressing, but it just like the nights that I do episodes about Emma, I will give my son extra hugs that night mm-hmm. because it's just, you know, the idea of it and the fact that this is real, like Shelley and Emma's friends and family, they're real people with, you know, open wounds and raw emotion. And it's, you know, I just feel like with a case like this and people going through this sort of thing, I feel like everybody in Canada should just stop what they're doing and help in any way they can. I just happen to have a podcast as you do. And that's just, you know, this is my way to help. But I just, that's really it. I just find the connection to the family and friends is just a huge motivator, but it also, it makes it feel really heavy sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I know exactly what you mean, because we most of the time we tell ourselves that we are entertainers. You know, we are not real investigators, although we dig sometimes really deep to find the information, but at the end of the day we entertain people, you know. But when we did the Emma's case, we were like, okay, now, I mean, maybe for the, I wouldn't say for the first time, but for one of the first times, we felt useful that day. And we just couldn't stop looking for evidences. You know, most of the case we cover, sometimes they are super dark cases or stories that, you know, there's a mystery and we want to try to solve it. And every time we finish a recording, it's like, okay, I took this weight out of my shoulder. You know, I can jump to another story. I can talk about something else. But in the case of Emma, I was like, okay, we did this episode, but there's still more to do. There's still some more information to find and people to talk to. So I totally get why you wanted to launch this this new podcast, the Emma Filipov is Missing podcast, because at the end of the day, you want to be useful and you want to bring something to the investigation and the conversation.
Yeah, and I just think it's about awareness when you cover something like this. And you know, you talked about seeing yourself, your role as an entertainer, but when you're covering something like a missing person. A person's case like Emma's, being a good entertainer is going to get people to listen to your episode, and more people listening to your episode is basically them seeing, you know, a virtual version of a billboard saying, you know, have you seen this person? So, you know, by being an entertainer and putting together something like this, especially in your case, by doing it in the French language, you're going to get Emma's story to a lot of new people who wouldn't have heard it before. So it's, you know, like anybody covering this case is, or any other missing persons case, they're helping people. So long as they're responsible by doing the right research and making sure, you know, what they put out there is respectable, sensitive, and, you know, and above all, just, you know, effective and, you know, and sharing a good telling of the story. Where you did your episode of Distortion about Emma in the French language, I didn't have an opportunity to listen, although I did get some French-speaking friends to listen, and they all enjoyed it.
Oh, nice.
I'm curious what, like, towards the end of your episode, did you give your opinion on what you think may have happened?
Yeah, we don't have, like, a very, very clear theory. What we think, or at least what I think... Because my buddy Seb had a different theory. I don't know why he thinks she's gone in the woods, or she wanted to exit, you know, the modern society in a way. But my theory, I would say, was more like, I felt that, of course, mental illness played a huge role in this disappearance. And for me, the moment that really got me, like, oh, what happened during that time is, you know, all of the events that happened on that day, you know, buying this $200 prepaid credit cards, getting a cell phone, as she didn't have a cell phone prior to this purchase. And after that, taking a cab to the airport, it makes me want to think that she really wanted to leave. But what did happen? I mean, why didn't she leave at the end of the day, or maybe she did because we haven't found her. But I really felt that she wanted to leave. She had clear intentions to leave. I don't know where she wanted to go with this $200. We know she had more in her bank account, but I really feel that something clipped in her mind during that day. Maybe she reached the bottom of, you know, her depression or her paranoia, because she was very paranoid at the end. And I think she just wanted to leave society. And I don't know why, but I was like, okay, why did she buy this prepaid credit card? Is it to stay anonymous? So I was like, was she trying to buy a plane ticket for $200? But it's not so much. But maybe it's enough for, like, a domestic flight or something like that. But after that, I was like, yeah, but her passport was still in her van. So what did happen? I mean, nothing makes sense in this course of events. I don't know what you think about that. What happened during that night?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think it's kind of like most likely a mix of a lot of the theories. Like, I think certainly mental illness is the driving force that eventually led to her disappearance. But I believe maybe she was trying to get away and go somewhere and escape, a bad situation, what she perceived to be a bad situation. But I think her mental illness, whatever crisis or whatever mental crisis she was going through, I think was going to prevent her from being effective at doing whatever she decided to do. So if she did want to leave, I think she was in too much of a crisis to even go anywhere. When you look at her activities that day and the different versions of the sightings of people who ran into her that day, it's obvious that she was in no state to do anything complicated.
Yeah, like no state to take a big decision.
To make a big decision. And, the people who talk about like a common theory is that, she fled and she's living among the homeless as a way to escape, the modern society. If that is the case, I don't think it's a voluntary thing that she decided to do. I think whatever the crisis that she was experiencing, I believe to be a mental health crisis, I believe that would have affected her ability to strategically decide to, run away and hide out somewhere. I just don't see that happening. I think she went off somewhere, and whether she ended up somewhere or I don't know what happened to her. And it's hard to even come up with a theory, but I talked to Aaron at Generation Y about this. Is the only real lead we have as to where she could have went is the credit card that was found about a 2-hour mm-hmm. walk away from Victoria. So if you believe that she dropped that credit card 2 hours outside of Victoria, I'm thinking, that may be the trail that she was walking, and who knows where she went from there. But if I had an unlimited budget and I was going to hire a search party, I would send them down that way and to start looking around. That's kind of as far as my theory goes.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. Do you think that she wanted to go to the airport to potentially meet her mother that was coming her way?
I thought about that. It could have been either, because it's been said that she had she knew that Shelley was coming to Victoria, although Shelley thought she was coming without Emma knowing. Emma did know somehow. So I'm thinking it could have been a few things. One is it could have been Emma was in such a bad state that she wanted her mother's help, so she wanted to get to the airport to meet her mother. Or another thing is she could be afraid to face her mother and she wanted to flee town. So maybe she was going to try to go to the airport to get out of town. It could have been either, but there was something about the airport, obviously. We know she, at least for a moment, considered going there. I'm thinking it most likely she was in a really, really bad place in her head, and she wanted to find Shelley. I'm thinking when she was getting into the car, I have a feeling it was with the intention to go to the airport to find Shelley. But then you still question, why did she get a credit card and a cell phone that day? How does that fit into mm-hmm. wanting to go see? Like, it's obvious she was planning something, because she made two trips to the 7-Eleven store to get the credit card and the phone, one in the morning, one in the evening. So whatever she was doing was something that was kind of happening all day. So it's just such a mystery with this. You have all of these little pieces of evidence that are not even evidence. You just have all these details, but none of them really connect in any logical way. That only makes sense because Emma wasn't acting logically.
And what about the woman's shelter? Because obviously, when she was staying there, they did interviews with her. She needed to get interviews to be allowed to stay there. And they reported that at some point she she had a lot of paranoia. She was taking a lot of the furniture in the front yard of the woman's shelter. And do you think that, you know, these people from the Sandy Merriman are, I wouldn't say hiding something, but do you think that they know some stuff that could help the investigation going on, but they just can't tell them because of professional secrecy?
Yeah, I think that the people at the shelter, their hands are likely tied by privacy law. I think they probably told the police more than they told Shelley, or more than they told, you know, CBC or something like that. But I think they may not know what happened to Emma, but I'm sure they know a lot about her behavior and her attitude and her health in the days leading up to her disappearance. The privacy law, I understand Emma's an adult, and if she is out there somewhere, maybe she doesn't want the shelter, you know, giving out all of her information or something. But I just feel like the privacy law needs to account for the fact that, you know, the mother of a missing person should have access to all of the information that they have. And the way the shelter handled Shelley's requests for information, that bothers me, like as a human, it just doesn't feel right. But at the same time, I understand the need for privacy laws. So I don't know if the shelter is hiding anything. I think more so the shelter is worried about being sued by somebody.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah, but it's just like when you're as a person, it just doesn't seem right. Like I'm thinking, you know, if I was king of the world, I would just say, tell Shelley everything you guys know. But you know, with laws and all this stuff, especially the Privacy Act, it's new and it's a, you know, it's a big deal. And something like a woman's shelter, you know, their value for privacy should be, you know, really, really high. But there needs to be some way to account for the fact that this is a mother looking for her daughter, and, you know, anything that they know could be helpful. But I do believe they likely told the police everything they know. So the police certainly know a lot more than Shelley does about this.
Thank you, Jordan, for all of these good information on the Emma's case. I think you did an amazing job talking with Emma's friends, talking to Shelley, even talking to Julian. And I highly encourage our listeners to go and check your show if they want to dig more into Emma's case. Also, can you tell us a little bit more about this new show that you just launched about Emma?
Yeah, so what I did was on my show, The Nighttime Podcast, generally I'll have each episode or every second episode is a new story. So it's kind of a variety podcast, much like yours is, where you're covering different things all the time. But what I found was I kept revisiting Emma's story. So I would do episode 2, then 2 months later I'd do part 3 of it. And as it continued, the series kind of grew. So I have, say, 55-ish episodes of the Nighttime Podcast, but if you go through there, there's a 7-part series of Emma's story kind of broken up between my 55 episodes. So the problem I was having was for a new listener who would come to my show, they weren't able to listen to Emma's episode one after the other. They would have to listen to part 1 of Emma, a bunch of stuff about, you know, mysteries and other crimes and whatnot, then part 2 of Emma. So I kind of wanted to have Emma's story one after another laid out somewhere for someone to just dive right in and listen to all 7 or 8 hours of it. The other thing is I wanted to dig even deeper without putting out too many episodes that the casual listener of my show wouldn't be interested in. Because, again, where I'm a variety podcast covering different things all the time, I have listeners who listen to my show specifically for episodes about the paranormal, yeah. Some specifically about true crime, some specifically for Emma's story. So what I didn't want to do is for the people, let's say, who are who are listening for the paranormal stories, I wouldn't want to put out too many episodes in a row about Emma, because they may that may turn some people off who aren't following the story. So by putting Emma's series as a standalone podcast called Emma Philippoff is Missing, it allows me to put all the multi-part series out there one after another, but also I can now do extra episodes where where that would appeal specifically to people who are following Emma's story. That'll save me from having to backtrack and re-explain her case and explain how different things are relevant. Now I can just dive right in and get into it knowing that the audience are people who are following Emma's story to begin with. So that's basically what got me to launch Emma Filipov is Missing. Basically, now I can have an audience listening to that that's, you know, well aware of the case and, again, give me the freedom to dig even deeper.
And since you covered a lot of different stories, Jordan, especially on the nighttime podcast, like you said, it's like a variety podcast. What is the most mysterious Canadian story, apart from Emma's one, that you covered?
Huh. Oh man, there's so many strange Canadian stories. I get into some pretty strange stuff. I'm really into the UFO phenomenon or any kind of paranormal mysteries. And I know just by me saying UFO, there's a good fraction of your audience right now just rolled their eyes. But I would challenge them to listen to some of the episodes about different UFO sightings that I've done.
Oh, I'm sure we have a lot of UFO fans among our audience. I'm sure we
do. Yeah, but you probably also have some that say, that's so stupid. But the thing is, when I say UFO or when UFO researchers say like UFO, they're not talking about an alien craft. They're just talking about some unidentified aerial phenomenon in the sky that people can't explain. Now, in Nova Scotia, where I'm from, there's a UFO event called the Shag Harbor Incident. This is an unexplained UFO sighting that was seen by almost an entire town of people, also seen by the Canadian Coast Guard, who responded because initially it was thought to be a downed aircraft. There was also several RCMP officers on site. Everybody saw the same thing, and to this day it hasn't been explained. This sighting, the Shag Harbor sighting, is known around the world as Canada's Roswell because it's one of the most researched and investigated UFO sightings, and it has a whole lot of evidence and documents showing, you know, the government investigated and all this stuff. And I know something happened that day or that night in the sky and in the water surrounding Shag Harbor. But as far as what, I have no idea. That I would think is one of the big ones, one of the big Canadian mysteries. The Oak Island mystery is world famous. Yeah, world famous and a huge mystery. I have no idea if something's buried under that island, and if so, I have no idea what it is. But people have been digging, spending their money, and dying trying to figure out for 221 years they've been doing this, trying to figure out what's below the island. And the last one, aside from Emma Filipov's disappearance, another disappearance that is always in my mind, that I'm always thinking about, that I'd love to cover more, is the April 2016 disappearance of Michaela Bali. She's a 16-year-old from Yorkton, Saskatchewan. She basically the Coles notes, or the short version of what happened, is uncharacteristically she skipped her high school. She didn't go to class. Instead, she kind of spent the day hanging out at Tim Hortons, texting on her phone and kind of walking around kind of in circles around the neighborhood until she just vanished. And there's really no sign of where she could have went. There's her bank account's never been touched. She wasn't into trouble. She was more than a risk taker. She was kind of like a nerdy girl. She was kind of like she's like a bookworm. She spent most of her time, you know, reading and practicing, I think violin. But whatever happened to Michaela and wherever she is, it seems like it's likely that somebody was interacting with her through technology, likely Snapchat, but they found no trace of who she was talking to, despite police officers having access to her phone. But one of the huge mysteries in Canada is, where is Michaela Bali? I covered her case on an episode of my show, and I included her mother as my guest, and that's one that I think you guys should dive into, because there's a lot of technology and kids using the internet and what harm could come of that, all kind of mixed into Michaela's case, and it's a huge mystery.
Thank you for that. I mean, my next question was just like that. I mean, is there any story that we should keep on our radar for distortion? So this one is obviously a pretty good one.
Yeah, Michaela's definitely. As far as other cases, I call it the series. It's a four-part series. I'm actually working on the fifth part, which will be my next episode. I call it the Sunray series, and it's the story of a girl from Newfoundland, a 20-year-old girl who initially it started as a missing persons case. She ran away from home. Nobody knew where she was, and they were searching around Newfoundland for her until she turned up in a YouTube video sitting in the background of a of a cult leader from Costa Rica. So when she was found in this YouTube video with the cult in Costa Rica, her family went to the Canadian government, who went to the Costa Rican government and the immigration authorities to try to get this girl back from Costa Rica to return with her family. And rather than coming back, what she did was she set up a Facebook account, and she was just doing these really long the live feed things where she was just basically calling her family demons and, you know, wanting nothing to do with them. She ended up coming home, and I did an episode where she was a guest on my show describing why she left and how she ended up back in Newfoundland. And then I did two episodes where I interviewed and kind of told the life story of the cult leader that she was living with in Costa Rica. He uses the name Nature Boy. But what this turned me on to, this story, is there are we all have heard about cults and, you know, the Manson family and all this sort of thing. But the phenomenon surrounding cults and new religious movements is much more nuanced than what you would think if you just read about, you know, the most common ones. And today, with the internet and YouTube and all this putting so many people in contact with each other, there's this whole new version of cults that is happening right now on YouTube. There are thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of spiritual leaders or religious teachers or whatever you want to call them that are just sitting in front of a webcam talking to the kids of the world and trying to compel them to see the world in their way. And Nature Boy, who I did a two-part series on, he is an American stripper, maybe prostitute, who left the United States to go to Costa Rica to start his own society, basically, or a religious group or cult or whatever you want to call it. And what he does is he spends, you know, if there's 24 hours in a day, well, not if, there is, of the 24 hours in a day, he's probably doing 6 to 10 hours of just live feeds where he's just talking about his beliefs, holding his phone in front of him, and people from all over the world interact with this guy and are willing to fly down to Costa Rica to, you know, give up their life and join him. And there's a lot of people like Nature Boy that are doing that. So one thing when I was going through that series that shocked me is just that this stuff is happening on the internet. And it really made me think about whether or not I'm going to let my kid go on the internet when he gets older.
Oh my God. Yeah. Internet is a scary place.
And
maybe we'll have the chance to talk about, you mentioned your kids going on the internet, but there's so many strange things happening on YouTube for kids, man. It's crazy.
I actually just read an article today about people making videos directed towards kids that are actually like violent and have obscene content within them, but it's kind of disguised as like a video, like a toy unboxing or something. And that kind of freaks me out, because my son, for a treat sometimes, I'll give him the iPad and he just opens YouTube and he's just going through unboxing videos. He loves them. But after reading this article today, I'm going to have to keep an ear open a bit more when he's doing that.
Yeah.
Because there are people that are kind of like trolling the kids, like, you know, it'll start with an unboxing video and then all of a sudden the toys are getting ripped apart and, you know, fake blood all over the place or something.
Jordan, it was an honor to have you on the show. I hope you enjoyed your time talking a little bit more about Hema's case and other mysterious cases. And yeah, thank you very much for your time, buddy.
No problem. And thank you for doing what you're doing. It's awesome. Like I have such an appreciation for people who are willing to podcast, because for the most part, it's a loveless hobby. But there are a lot of people who are listening to your show that are getting free, good entertainment. And the fact that you're doing it in French is awesome, because I know that there's a big hole in the market of independent podcasters that are doing it in that language. So thank you for everything you do on the show.
Thank you very much, Jordan. And yeah, same for you, man. Keep up the good work, and we'll make sure to look at any new shows that you're producing.
Awesome.